Hey friends, welcome to the Book Spider Podcast, a book of the week style program that delves into a variety of literary, philosophical, and cultural critical topics. This time around, we're discussing Post Office, the debut novel of infamous poet Charles Bukowski. The novel follows protagonist Hank Chernesky, an analog of Bukowski himself, whose first name was Henry. Although his first name was really Heinrich, because he was born in Germany, but he Americanized it when he moved over here. So Hank wanders around in the novel through 3 years as a letter carrier for the United States Post Office, and then after a long hiatus, 12 years as a clerk. The novel is full of drunkenness, womanizing, smoking, gambling, and all-around debauchery, including a shocking incident in which Chernesky rapes a confused and terrified woman while he's out delivering the mail. The novel is thinly autobiographical, making this incident even more controversial. Maybe because of the autobiographical nature of the novel, Post Office feels very un-novel-like, without any of the hallmarks of traditional plot structures like rising action, climax, or resolution. It kind of feels more like a series of vignettes and anecdotes that are just connected by the fact that they happen to the same character over the course of time. But it doesn't feel much like a novel to me. So let's move on to getting into the questions that listeners will know that whoever picks the episode's book writes beforehand and asks fellow hosts. And so I think we should just start with, where we all know we have to start, which is, why is this novel so bad?
We know we have to start.
Right? Like, that's where we have to start. We all know this is terrible. So what makes it so terrible?
I don't think this is a terrible novel. I don't think it's a great novel.
Oh, all right.
But okay. Why do you think it's so terrible?
Well, for me, I think I have to go back to that article we read a while ago called Moderate Moralism. And basically, the author of Moderate Moralism put forth the idea that sometimes moral considerations are, in fact, aesthetic considerations. And the example he gives is from Aristotle. So Aristotle points out that if you're writing a tragedy, but the main character is not empathetic enough, then the work will not turn out tragic because your audience won't care enough about your character to be moved. And I think that the same thing is going on here, where we have this pretty terrible main character, this kind of low-life scum dude named Hank Chernesky. And, as I've already pointed out, like in one of his anecdotes, he is delivering the mail. He comes upon a confused and terrified woman outside of her house. She is scantily dressed in like a robe and underwear, and he can kind of see her body, and like she's definitely scared. She's like, now I think that the character, this person, this woman is confused, like she doesn't know what's happening, and she's not sure what, like she thinks that the letter carrier is someone there to harm her, and it does end up harming her.
I think that we had very different readings of that scene.
Okay.
I think
okay.
that.
Well, hold on to that thought.
I mean, I don't want to hang. If the whole idea, like if the whole analysis we're doing here is hung on character is rapist, thereby bad, novel bad because protagonist rapist, then I just, you know.
No. That's not.
There's more to the analysis.
That's not my
than
line
that.
Of okay. rant. Yes. So we can certainly have a bad character in a great novel. We read The Dwarf not too long ago. The dwarf, the dude's awful. Picoline's a terrible person, but the novel's great. The difference is that in this novel, I don't see any reason that we're not meant to identify with the main character. I don't see any like ironic distance. And that's what I think the problem is. We're not seeing this character. I don't feel like we're seeing this character to kind of analyze what his problems are and to think about those problems in any kind of deep way. I think really we're mostly just kind of meant to feel somewhat empathetic for the kind of bullshit that the character faces as an employee of the post office, which the character does face bullshit. The post office is often a bullshit place. But so I would say that this particular incident works like the example of Aristotle kind of points out. This incident works against the purposes of the novel. So that's why I think it's flawed. That's one of the main reasons, I think. One of the main shortcomings of the novel.
I mean, I think, like, again, you know, you said we could return to the particular rape incident. So setting that aside, but...
Sure, yeah, let's...
I, just in general, thinking more broadly about the novel, I mean... I think one thing that you pointed out that I think is important is the absence of ironic distance, right? Like, it's not like right. The Dwarf or Lolita or something like that, where your narrator protagonist is awful, but there are clues within the novel that are meant
right.
to point us toward the understanding that we are meant to critique his awfulness. I think the issue, well, he's an awful person living in an awful world, I suppose. And that is where we are. That's why we're meant to kind of forgive his awfulness, is because essentially everyone is awful. There is nothing good in the world as he experiences it. No one is kind. Mm. No one is loyal. Mm. Even, you know, beyond the kind of critique of the drudgery of post office work or the sort of aggravating micromanagement of his supervisors, just nobody he meets is good. Nobody he meets does him right in any kind of consistent way. Everybody is completely out for themselves, short-sighted, shallow. So I think we're meant to understand his selfishness, his shallowness, his meanness as being a logical response to a world that is consistently the same way, right? It's not like he is being an asshole and others around him are better than him. He is simply reacting logically to a world where all work is drudgery, women are unfaithful, nobody loves you in a meaningful or enduring way other than Betty, who just immediately dies. There's nothing good in the world. Like, the world does not deserve goodness, therefore he is not a bad person for giving it badness, right? Which is just it's really kind of an unpleasant thing to live in, you know, like to the extent that you like live in a novel while you read it, maybe there's light there that I did not see, but the just kind of continuous unremitting bleakness of it, I found
sure.
just unpleasant, you know, and it was an unpleasantness that was not leavened by... It'd be one thing if it had that unremitting bleakness, but there was a truly compelling plot, or that unremitting bleakness, but it was witty at a line level, right? Or if it just had...
Right, right.
It just is not, as a novel, it's just not particularly good. and everyone and everything in it is shitty. And so it ended up, yeah, being a pretty unpleasant experience.
Right.
I think
I'll tell. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I think like I'm not going to defend the novel like on any aesthetic or moral merits. I think that it's, I feel like this novel has to exist. Like something like this has to be created, has to come out. When did this come out? In the 70s?
Yeah, it was 1971, I think, is when it published.
Yeah, this feels like, you know how some technological inventions, they're invented by several people contemporaneously across the world, because that's just as where the scientific,
like calculus and evolution.
Yeah, well, I was thinking I think the light bulb was invented by two different people at, you know, like who weren't talking to each other, and that is representative of a couple things, that like technology was at that point where it was inevitable that the light bulb be created by someone. So it didn't really matter who, someone was going to come up with it. And also like just culturally, like we were at a place where we were interested in extending light during the working day. So like, I feel like Bukowski, I don't know Bukowski super well, but what I know of him and this novel, it feels like this is sort of a necessary touchstone of the 70s that like someone had to write.
Sure.
And
I like that theory a lot, actually.
Oh, cool. Yeah. No, go ahead, Hans. You were going
to
say something?
Well, I was just going to say, you had compared it to like evolution or the light bulb. If you want to think about it in an artistic context, you might compare it to 4:33 by John Cage, right?
Oh, yeah.
Somebody had to make a piece of music that was just silence, because suddenly the possibility was there because of the way that the boundaries of the form had shifted. And John Cage happened to be the one who did it and managed to claim that idea. In the context of the early 70s, the way that like the culture was changing and the way that boundaries were expanding, somebody had to make a novel that was just bleakness, blackness, drunkenness, horse racing. Somebody had to like, you know, take the canvas and just put a big black square on it. And it happened to be Bukowski, and he has laid claim to that idea in the way that John Cage laid claim to the idea of a piece of music that is just silence.
I think.
Oh, really? I thought that was typo negative.
Well, they ripped it off.
You're just talking about the long, awkward silences in October Rust, or what is it called?
On Slow, Deep, and Hard, they actually have a track called The Misinterpretation of Silence and Its Disastrous Consequences, and it's just a minute of silence.
Oh.
There's also,
well, they're just cribbing from Cage.
Yeah, there's also Soundgarden covered, quote unquote, the John Lennon song 1 minute of silence, but whereas the Lennon song is a song, like their cover is just literally a minute of silence. So it's, you know, like,
right.
I don't know if they knew they were ripping off Cage, right? But anyway, your point is a very good one, I think, and I like it, and I didn't want it to be derailed, but.
Well, and I think that like, this is maybe like a very narrow window to pass praise for this novel through, but like I think that like this novel does something at least interesting with the ray of light that is the little bit of light that is in the novel, because, and I don't know that it works, I don't know that it works today at all, but like the, you know, Bukowski's stand-in for himself, Chinaski, because basically I think this is thinly veiled autobiography, like Patrick was saying, is a monster. He's really reprehensible, but it does feel like some of the little bits of empathy and concern that we get, like, for humanity come from Chinaski. And like I said, I don't know that works as like a package. You know, you have a shitty world, you have a shitty person, and then in that shitty, maybe even like I'd say that Chinaski may be shittier than the world that he's in. But like, but then within Chinaski, you have this this sense of concern that is pretty guttering and not. Not that meaningful, but it's there. It's there for his dog. It's there for Betty. It's there for Gigi. I think that section, that chapter about Gigi was maybe my favorite in the whole novel. And I find that interesting. And I think that like for a novel that is just basically, hedonistic, a sort of hedonistic low response to very fabricated facades of civilization in the 70s, just like a very, very bitter denunciation of institutions and the workday and bosses and everything that is put upon a person to, you know, survive in society. I think that the novel could have been even more gross, but there was a little bit of something that was in it that I find interesting enough to not outright hate the novel. I just don't think that it works today, and I don't know that I would enjoy it if I'd read it 50 years ago for the first time.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, I think that you're right that there are the moments that you mentioned where Chinaski does show some kind of compassion or feeling. I think that again, because it's, and maybe this comes down to a fault of being autobiographical, if those were connected to any kind of like large-scale change in the character or any kind of detectable mm-hmm. arc, I think they would be much, much more satisfying and easier to come away with, right? Because yeah. Because it would give them, it would amplify their significance and their meaning, you know? And it instead, because it is structurally just kind of a flat line, they don't carry the same, they don't have the same importance that they could.
Yeah, I agree.
I'm wondering if, you know, if this weren't called a novel, if, you know, if the main character just called himself, Charles Bukowski, and like it were presented as a short memoir, something like that, would the straight line structure be more acceptable?
I don't think it would be more acceptable. No, I mean, I think a nonfiction writer probably, like a really, you know, a good essayist, would bristle at the idea that nonfiction doesn't have the same requirement for some kind of satisfying structure, right? You can't,
right.
You're even in creative nonfiction, you're not allowed to just lay out everything that happens over a 30-year period in
right,
a flat line
right, exactly.
with no, you know, you have to have analysis and you have to have some sense of what it means and where it goes. And you
right.
you have to take, if in nonfiction, you have to take the big lump of event and add meaning onto it, right? And if anything, I would say that this actually I think might be worse as nonfiction than it is as a novel, because there is, no attempt made to extract meaning from the big lump of events.
Right.
There's no meaning other than everything sucks, everyone is shitty, and it's fine for me to be a selfish alcoholic because the world does not deserve any better. And you can get that from 10 pages of it just as well as 200 pages of it.
So that this thing is bad. We all agree that it's got a lot of shortcomings. I think I'm less optimistic than you, Hans. Like, or not Hans, Chris. Like, I definitely get what you're saying when you say, you know, this something like this was deterministically bound to emerge, you know, given the constraints of society. And I think that's fine, fine to say. I'll be honest in saying that I'm not sure that feels like anything important aesthetically, like, I think it's one thing to say that a certain art form or a certain specific work of art was bound to come around due to like human society in the time that it was created, and that's one type of observation. And then there's like observations about what it is and what it does. So I don't know. I guess I'm just saying that doesn't necessarily save it to my mind. Like, it doesn't really make it better.
Yeah.
It just makes it understandable, I guess.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. I think that's totally fair. I think that, like,
right.
I think another way to put it is that this book, because it's more structural, like structural necessity than affectation, if you're talking about the canon of just literature, like something like this has to exist on the far like perimeter of, you know, where we found ourselves in, you know, I think that it's, you know, fair to say that like there was more art coming out, and good art too, in the 60s and 70s that was really intensely, that was trying to not examine itself, that was trying to just be experiential and strange and shocking and honest in a way that like we couldn't be honest maybe, or it was difficult to be honest through art before that time. So like I think it's fair to say that this doesn't really serve the same kind of purpose in the canon, you know, or it shouldn't. Like, it, you know, I hope people aren't reading this and saying like, I really want to be Bukowski today. No, I think that's fair.
And it is possible, I suppose. I mean, it should be said that none of us have read any other Bukowski, right? Which is pretty unusual. It's very rare on this podcast that we tackle a work where we have no understanding of the author's larger body at all, you know? And so it is possible. There's
those verses on Eddie's arms.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, yeah. We all have a good friend who has lines from Bukowski poetry tattooed on his arms. But it is possible, I think, that his other work has more dimension to it. You know, the lines that Eddie has on his arms, if I remember right, is "We're all in the gutter. Some of us are looking at the stars." I don't feel like in this novel anybody's looking at the stars, right?
Right.
I do recognize
everybody's
that
just in the gutter.
Everybody's just in the gutter. They're not looking at the stars. I do recognize that if you read the poetry or the other novels and people are looking at the stars, that's going to probably change the subjective experience of this work, right? But I don't think it's unreasonable to expect also a novel to it's not unreasonable to expect to be able to approach it as a freestanding object. And absent a greater knowledge of Bukowski's life or personality or work, I just don't see much here in terms of mostly anything other than kind of nastiness and relatively meager craft.
Yeah. I want to bring up a comparison that came to my mind while listening to this, while I was out delivering the mail. I just thought about the amusing nature of delivering mail while listening to someone write about how they're delivering mail and raping people. So I thought that was
I really hope that all the people who like this novel at least wait until the part where I would imagine that they're all like, you know, waving their hands and frothing and saying, it's not a rape scene, and waiting for, I hope they stick around long enough for us to give that more thought, because I do think we might be, again, misunderstanding that. To just
expand on that. Maybe try that now.
Patrick, you had a thought that you wanted to say something. I don't know.
Well, I'll say it real quick, and then we'll move to talking about, because this is the second time you brought it up. I just wanted to bring up that I thought a lot about Henry Miller when I was listening to this. And how,
and you love, know, Henry Chris, Miller. Henry Miller is one of your,
well, I, one of I your used dogs. To, I, yeah, Henry Miller used to be like super, like I used to super be into Henry Miller right around the time that like we all met in 2008, or 2000, yeah, 2008. And that's faded quite a bit over time. Like I care less and less about, like, I actively now think that, like, that kind of lifestyle, kind of a, like, down and out, blatant kind of nasty individualism combined with promiscuity is not actually like a moral or ethical stance that I'm interested in, nor do I want to experience it. But I felt a lot like they were doing similar things, except that Henry Miller has the benefit of like being more experimental on a line level, and being like, his work is full of like kind of nasty things, like someone, you know, someone getting chlamydia from his girlfriend or whatever, but Miller's attitude is always just like, it's life, keep on going, it doesn't matter, just live and be happy. And like, as unsophisticated as that is, I think it's a little bit better than this particular novel. Like, it would be nice, as we've already said, and that you and Hans and Chris have pointed out, that like, it's just nastiness and nastiness after nastiness. And if there were some kind of secondary attitude or distance from that nastiness, it would be a benefit to this novel. And like, Miller at least had that in his writing. But anyway, that's, We can move on from that, and you can explain your interpretation of the rape scene, and we'll see if you convince me that I'm wrong.
I would say before we get into that, I can imagine, just thinking further about why this might be meaningful and valuable to people. You know, if you're 19 and your whole experience with literature has been what you get in high school classes, I would imagine that this would feel, sure, radically honest in a way that, mm-hmm, you know, Dickens does not to a contemporary 19-year-old. Or I don't even know what people, right, read in high school classrooms. I don't know. To Kill a Mockingbird, right? Obviously, To Kill a Mockingbird is a better novel than this, but this probably would feel like something, if you're a callow 19-year-old, this might feel like something that is rendering the world in a direct, no bullshit way that your experience with literature, you know, would not have matched. So I can see why that might feel inspiring, you know?
Sure, absolutely. Like, there's a reason that I used to think Henry Miller was cool. It was his, you know, no bullshit individualism, like, you know, the world's crap and I'm going to talk about how it's crap.
Everybody feels that way sometimes, then, and there's a value.
Right. Everybody feels that
art,
way.
As long as that's part of the process of acquiring a larger consciousness.
Right, absolutely.
As far as the rape scene goes, I don't think it's a rape scene. I think we're meant to understand that. Like, and I know that, like, this is dated very poorly, et cetera, et cetera. With all the normal caveats, I think we're meant to understand that as kink on her part, not as him violating her will, right? I think that we're meant to understand that as her deliberately arranging a scenario from a kinky desire. Because, I mean, just thinking through the details of it, he has a registered letter, right? So he's got to get a signature to give her the letter. He, leaving aside the fact that she has a crazy vibe, right? Like, everybody has a crazy vibe in this novel, right? He comes with a registered letter. The reason he goes into the house is because he tries to get her to sign for it, and she just grabs it and runs in, right? And he's going to get in trouble if he comes back without either a signature or the letter. He's got to have either the signature or the letter. So, you know, when he forces his way into the house, he has to, and he has told her, I've got to have the signature or the letter, one of the two, and she has refused to give him either. He goes into the house to pursue it. He gets her to sign for it very poorly, and he tries to leave, and she stands in front of the door with her arms spread and says, you came here to rape me. He tries to get past her, and she scratches his face and won't let him by and says, no, no, you're an evil man and you came here to rape me. And at that point, he then, you know, so, you know, she takes steps to get him into the house, then stands in front of the door, won't let him leave, and says, you came here to rape me. So I don't think that it, again, like, this is not how we do a kink scenario in 2025, right? There are many, and I don't think that, like, whatever real life experience of Henry Bukowski, you know, inspired this, I don't think that it was, I don't think that it, I'm sure it was not good by maybe even the standards of the time. But I mean, she, my reading of that, if we grant the novel its own worldview, is that she deliberately lures him inside, won't let him leave, and then is, you know, because of her crazy desires, is trying to arrange a kink scenario in which she is quote unquote raped.
I'll say this. I'm willing to say I'm not sure, pending going back and reading the section, which I will never do because I don't care enough.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. It's just like, you know, the way you introduce the novel, like, that scene is very front loaded again. So already said that that's not actually like a load bearing thing in your kind of analysis of it, but to try to be fair to a book that otherwise we've been pretty shabby to.
Yeah, I think, yeah, so. Yeah, he's a piece of shit. Like he doesn't, like, he doesn't need to be a rapist to be a piece of shit. I read it kind of. I got the sense that you did, Hans, while reading it, and I felt like it was, you know, Bukowski moves very fast. Right, his writing style is to be pretty glancing over details of, you know, what things look like, you know, what people look like, other than female body parts. He really lingers on those, but he moves very fast, and there's not like it's not an unreliable narrator. It's a very myopic and fuzzy viewpoint, you know, because, like, I think that, like, it's really probably impossible to say, you know, one way or another about the rape scene. But I got the same impression that you did, Hans, that it was a kind of engineered moment that he was seizing upon. So it's just, yeah. But he's a shitty person regardless.
He's a shitty person regardless. To be fair again to the novel, I suppose, in general, like, this could be a much longer novel if it had more... I mean, in general, he's like such a minimalist writer, right? And right. Another writer might have said something to the effect of, then I realized she was trying to engineer a scene because she had a weird kink where she wanted to arrange a rape scene.
Yeah,
and, for sure. And just in general, like, he doesn't say that here, but he doesn't say that kind of thing anywhere, right?
No.
He doesn't do that kind of analysis. He doesn't explain. The character doesn't reflect on what he thinks other people are thinking, what he sees their motivations as being. It's very, very minimal, which to some extent is good, because I don't think it would add much aesthetic merit if you added a lot of that, but it probably might bloat the novel another 50 or 100 pages. In this narrow instance, it's a flaw to modern sensibilities, because we want to be reassured that he understands, and within the world of the novel, this is an engineered scenario, and we don't have that reassurance, which is much more meaningful to us now than what, you know, would have been to somebody in 1972 or whatever. But.
So not to you know, belabor this point, because as we've already said, like, if this is rape or not rape, like, the main character is still a dick, and it's still an issue that the novel doesn't take enough ironic distance from him. However, why aren't we just taking things at face value when, after this whole scenario, like, he has sex with her on the couch, she's screaming rape or yelling rape or whatever. She's like, rape, rape. And he's like, and she was right.
Well,
why, like, aren't we taking it at face value when she stands in front of the door and won't let him leave? I think that the, and again,
but that's,
like,
indirect.
We're wanting,
like,
to,
he directly says, and she was right.
Well, so
yes, because
I was raping her.
She's trying to arrange a rape scenario. She's trying to set up a situation in which she inspires true feelings of, like, whatever it is that is inspired in a rapist's heart, she's trying to inspire that.
Also,
I don't want to be sitting here saying this. I don't like this. I'm not, I don't think any of this is good, right?
Patrick.
I just don't think that, like, I don't think within the worldview of the novel, I don't believe this person is meant to be construed as an innocent victim.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I said, I'll
Patrick.
I'll reserve judgment.
Another
again.
Which you won't do. Another
which I won't do.
Another factor is pretty soon after that, he basically curses at someone in a house through their screen door, and he gets back to the post office and he's convinced that he's fucked, because this person that he cursed at through a screen door is going to call and get him in trouble. So if you kind of, like, compare those two things, you know, one, raping somebody.
Oh,
two,
and him being scared that somebody else is going to.
Yeah, he's not.
Well, I guess I thought there that, like, I took her confusion as real.
Uh-huh.
So, like, when she so I was taking it all as real, not engineered. So, like, if she's not engineering something,
she's confused.
It still makes a little sense. She's confused. She gets in front of him to scratch him, to, like, kind of bat him away. But because she's not confused, she doesn't realize that he is trying to leave. So I think it's ambiguous enough that I'm still not sure. But I do think that you do have a point, Chris. Like, if he is worried about someone tattletaling him that he had words with them, he would also be worried that somebody would tattletale that he raped them, right? Yeah. Yeah. The only thing that is still ambiguous is if she's confused, she wouldn't necessarily know to call anything.
I think that at this time, like,
but whatever.
I think that
we don't have to keep talking about it.
Yeah, no, this is definitely way too long on this one moment. But I think that right. I think that we have a different appreciation of mental, like soundness and someone being able to have agency on their own behalf now than I would not be surprised if in the early 70s there is very little social substrate on which like concern for people's lack of agency over themselves. I don't know that there is, I think that she could be confused and crazy and still be portrayed as engineering the moment. Like, I think that is part of the ambiguity of it, because I just don't know that, like, there was awareness at the time of, oh, you're not in your right head. You know, I probably shouldn't, you know, do this with you, because that would be irresponsible. I think that one, Bukowski's just not, he doesn't give a shit about any of that, but like,
sure.
But two, I don't know that if it's either or. I don't think that she is either right in the head and engineering everything or not right in the head. And
no,
I think it's a mix.
If she's confused and not right in the head, even if she has a kink, it's still rape. She's confused. She can't give.
I don't think that in her
right mind.
By 2025 standard, it's rape.
Yeah, by 2021, yeah, sure.
Standards, it is not rape.
1971, that doesn't exist, Patrick. That is not
right.
That's not a
that. But that has nothing to do with what we're talking about. Like we're talking about whether. So you're saying that if this occurred in 2025, and she's confused but has a kink, that it's rape in 2025, but the exact same act in 1971 is not rape because the standards are different. I could debate with you on all day.
No, I'm saying that the you are trying to delineate like too cleanly between like whether she is in her right state of mind or engineering the situation based on like Bukowski's characters are all extremely flawed and fucked up. Like they're responding to their own impulses and they're not examining them. No one is really outside of themselves thinking about how they're behaving or whether thinking about, you know, other people and their relative state of mind or stability or their ability to make decisions or good decisions for themselves. Bukowski doesn't pay attention to that at all. And I think that in part that's text from the time. There is not the same like social awareness of therapy or, you know, trauma or a psychosis or anything that like, you know, we have now that makes these very clean delineations. I think that, you know, you do this a lot, Patrick. You get very morally righteous
that's because I'm correct.
Well, like, no,
I don't know what to do. Like, I could turn the tables on you and say you guys do this a lot, where you try to be in a gray area and ambiguous.
No, but
when they're like, it's not. It may be ambiguous what's happening.
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
I'm willing to say that.
Yes,
like, I'm not sure that this is rape. I'm not sure.
Well, the interpretation of fiction is by necessity ambiguous, right? There's there's the question, did Charles Bukowski believe he was writing a rape scene? I don't think that Charles Bukowski believed he was writing a rape scene.
And I agree with that. Okay. I absolutely agree with that.
Okay.
100%.
Was he doing something that would get you in at least social and ethical trouble, if not legal trouble, in 2025? Yeah, this is not a thing that would be acceptable to do in 2025.
But it probably would not have gotten him into trouble in 1971, though.
No, it wouldn't.
Like, he probably wouldn't have.
I totally agree.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. And
so...
I think we're actually all basically in agreement here. I think we actually all think roughly the same thing if we don't try to engineer a conflict. Like,
sure.
We all agree that Bukowski did not believe he was writing a rape, that the protagonist is a shithead either way, and that the standards have changed in ways that make this worse now.
For good reasons, worse now.
Sure.
Patrick, I want to break in here before you ask your last question, because, like, parts of this feel very close to, like they're I can't remember any lines because I didn't listen to this, I didn't read it, so I didn't make line notes in the same way. But, like, there were some lines about working, you know, at the post office, about just how shitty people are, and, like, just there were some things that felt very Patrick-y to me, like on a line level, the kind of clean, disparaging, cutting remarks that I value in your work, and they tickled me here too. Like, did you feel any of that as you really didn't like this novel?
Oh, yeah. No, I didn't like this novel for reasons we've already talked about. Like, I think it needs some ironic distance from the shittiness of its main character. I don't think we should be, you know, I feel like Bukowski is... like, let's identify with this nasty guy because the world is so nasty, which I didn't really like that. But if the novel has a redeeming quality, I think it's pretty good characterization of working for the post office, you know, minus the scene that we've been talking about with the confused woman. You know, like, the working for the post office is absolutely like the novel Catch 22 by Joseph Heller. Except, you know, you don't fear for your life so much, but it's like, you know, they tell you to. So every day they tell you to be safe, right? They're like, be safe. If it's too hot, take a rest. If it's too hot, take a drink of water. Every day they tell you to be safe, to take a break if you need it. Drink your water. You know, don't look at the mail while you're crossing the street. Don't look at the mail while you're walking up steps. But then they write you up if it takes you longer than 8 hours to do your job, right? So the work of the post office is like being punished for doing what you're told to do, pretty much, you know. And, you know, the character of the stone, for example, just a real jerk who just wants to punish Hank for everything, write him up for everything, and just because he's a sadist, right? He just enjoys punishing people. We have had a guy like that at my office for several months now. He actually just left. Like, he just left to go to a different station. I can't, like, everybody is so happy. This guy was reassigned to a different station, and I feel bad for all the carriers in Lachlan. But, yeah, man, like, you call off one day because you know, like I called off one day because I stepped on a nail. I thought I was fine. I looked at it in the morning and showed it to Tracy, and Tracy's like, you gotta call off. You gotta go to the doctor to get that looked at. So I did. I come back the next day and he's like, yeah, Patrick, we need to talk about your attendance. I'm noticing a pattern. There is no, like, I called off one day to check out my foot. It's not a pattern, dude, you know? So I think he captures the shittiness of management pretty well.
There it is, Patrick, and Patrick is Henry Chinaski.
Yep. 100%. Completely and totally. Hank Chinaski.
No, I think that's. I'm trying to think of like what other books. It feels like we've talked about this, but like the mid-century, like opened up, new avenues for being honest about things that that maybe for whatever reason social mores we weren't as honest about before, or didn't know how to be. And that includes sexuality. But it also includes, like, you know, just hating fucking society and hating work and hating, right, you know, hating that things are the way they are. And I think that this book is, you know, I don't hate this book. I don't like this book very much. It just was kind of a solid 5 out of 10 for me. But I think the thing that the pluses that get it up to a 5 really are those scenes in the post office, the,
right,
you know, just kind of actually like, I don't know what a sling is, or, you know, like, you know, routing all the letters, like, you know, routing all the mail, like getting everything organized. There's, sure, not a ton of,
yeah, he doesn't explain many of the terms that like are just known to me and other postal workers.
Yeah. Yeah. I found myself wishing there was more about that, you know, cause I liked that.
Yeah.
Stuff.
I think that could actually, like, if he were to chillax on playing the, you know, womanizing drunk, like, you know, if he just was like a normal dude instead of a womanizing drunk, this could have made a pretty interesting, like, expose on the post office and like what it's like to work for the post office, you know. But he'd have to be willing to like tell you, like, describe what a case looks like. And he says, you know, I dropped all the mail, I got to reroute it. Well, that just means, you know, resorting it so that it's in order again. You know, so there's just like a ton of things that he could have done that would have improved this, you know, made it more interesting to readers, I think, that, you know, it, like, if he had, you know, granted, back in the 70s, I'm not quite certain, like, the autobiographical novel has been replaced a little bit by, like, you know, people being more willing to just write a memoir, you know, like, they don't no longer feel they have to couch their experiences in, you know, metaphor, right? But if he had treated it as just, you know, a memoir and been willing to explain some stuff for the readers, it could have been pretty interesting. I did have a couple other questions. I don't feel that they're super necessary, so I'll just leave it open to you guys. Do you feel like there are more things you guys want to talk about in relation to this book? It's not like a super complex novel. We did, like really parse out this, the one scene, like kind of thinking about the ambiguity of it. Is there anything else we need to say?
There's one scene where he briefly works with someone who is an aspiring writer, and the aspiring writer gives him his novel, and he scoffs at the novel and says it's terribly unrealistic and stupid, and then it briefly seems as though his life is going to follow the plot of the novel he has just scoffed at. And that was almost a really interesting device, and then it lasted like two pages and fizzled. But there's like hints of that kind of like wit and complexity that I don't want to let them go unacknowledged, but I wish they'd been developed more.
Yeah. I mean, this was his first novel that I know of, his debut novel. Maybe he got better. Maybe he's better as a poet or a short story writer.
He seems more respected as a poet.
Right.
And yeah. I was just reading the Wikipedia on this book, and it suggested that he wrote the whole thing in 3 weeks, which feels about right.
Yeah, it does.
It might be that I don't want our dismissal of this work to be taken as an automatic dismissal of his like whole legacy or body.
He's obviously very skilled.
Somebody told Patrick to read it because he works for the post office. He did that, right. And here we are.
Yeah, it's
that's exactly what happened.
No, at moment by moment, like rape or potential rape scene aside, like it's a very and how bleak it is. It's very fucking funny. It's a funny ass book, you know. But like, you know, it's got a great voice.
I chuckled a few times.
Yeah, it's got a great voice, and
I think there's a reasonably pleasant minimalist voice under there.
I didn't find it that funny.
No. Yeah.
I wouldn't say I found it funny, like super funny.
It's fucking funny. Jesus.
I mean, I chuckled in a few places, but I wouldn't say it's fucking funny. Like, I would say there are a few amusing instances.
It's not funny. Nothing's funny. It's not funny at all.
So we got a good spectrum. Chris thinks it's fucking funny. Hans thinks it's not funny at all. And I'm in the middle. It's like sometimes amusing. Larry, Supervisor Larry, if you're listening to this, man, this is not that great. Like, I'm not exactly sure why you think it's great. So maybe we could talk about it the next time I see you. But you'd probably just tell me to get off the clock. So, yeah. So what are we reading next, Chris?
I don't know why, but I kind of want to read and talk about Macbeth. And I figure we do a couple, all right, an adaptation or two as well. I was wanting to see the most recent adaptation with Denzel Washington, and I like the old Polanski adaptation. Is that too much, you guys? Like the adaptations?
And, no.
I don't know if you need to read the play if you're watching that, but Hans, how does that sound to you?
Sure, that's fine.
Okay.
Yeah, sounds great to me. I don't think I have ever read or seen an adaptation of Macbeth.
Oh, no shit. No fucking way. How's that possible?
Well, I mean, I like Shakespeare, and I've read and watched a lot of his adaptations, but I haven't done this one. And besides, once you've read Titus Andronicus, his best play of all time, and seen the Anthony Hopkins great adaptation, you really don't, like, you don't need to waste your time on things like Hamlet or Macbeth.
Sure. All right. Yeah, absolutely. Sure, whatever. That's fine.
The overrated, the quote unquote best work that he's done
is Macbeth. His best, it's either Macbeth, Hamlet, or It's probably Macbeth or Hamlet, right? Those are the two.
I mean, I think Hamlet and Macbeth are up there, and Titus Andronicus is like consistently rated as his fucking worst.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. But all right. Let's do Macbeth and those two adaptations.
Sounds cool to me.
And I look forward to it, guys.
Yeah, me too.
All right,
gentlemen. Thanks for joining me to discuss my supervisor's pick. I apologize. And readers, if you really liked this, listeners, if you really liked this novel by old Bucky, I apologize to you as well. Peace out until next time.